You won't fly that plane if it is allowed to get into the air.
I'm only trying to school you. Listen to me, people. Do you understand? We gotta
stand
up. Oh, you've been sitting way too long.
Tell me a story about your time at WBAI so I can let people know that you, in fact, have returned from retirement.
I retired because I was tired, but I found retirement more tiring than coming to BAI. BAI can be exhausting. Trump's there, and you have to, you know, you have to yak about it. And if you're sitting at home, you're just shouting to the walls. When you have a program at WBAI, you can alert them about Donald Trump.
That's David Rothenberg. Tune in to any Saturday, Saturday mornings from 8 to 10.
This is a well-oiled promotion, please.
I believe that we have got to mobilize a larger movement to reclaim the democracy.
Radio broadcaster Bob Law.
Some of y'all have underestimated the value and the appeal of white supremacy. And you have no idea how strong white privilege and white supremacy is.
Tune in to From the Streets with Bob Law, which gives voice to a wide range of black and progressive political and cultural perspectives. That's 11 to noon Saturdays here over listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Don't tell me to stop. Tell the rain not to drop. Tell me everything I'm not. Don't.
Hi, this is Liz Wright. You're listening to WBAI in New York.
Morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name's Jim Freund. To start the new year off, I thought it would be fun to hold an in-depth discussion with our media critic, Dan Persons, about some of our most recent genre releases, especially Soul and Wonder Woman 1984, along with the future of genre cinema and a recap of some other things we have watched. Stay tuned. I am Jim Freund. With me is Daniel Persons, or Dan Persons, who does regular reviews in Hour of the Wolf, and he's been doing it for, I don't know how long. So people have been hearing Dan doing reviews on movie reviews, I should say media reviews, given a year without movies in theaters, with the
I've been calling it the year without superheroes, which is fine by me. Okay, I am the house critic for Hour of the Wolf, the house media critic, shall we say, for Hour of the Wolf. In addition to that, I've also been a regular contributor over at Tor.com, mostly doing, I guess they would be called listicles at the moment, you know, the top 10 animated films that'll make you cry, stuff like that. And I am also a proprietor over at MightyMoviePodcast.com, which was originally the home for my Mighty Movie Podcast, and is now sort of a catch-all for the things that I am doing online. I've also got a YouTube channel. You can look for Upstart Company. And that's the name of the channel there. And I am doing various and sundry video things, including most recently Historama 3D, which is an experiment in taking various types of public domain content and converting it to 3D, just to give it a sort of an interesting and curious recontexting.
We're going to have to do a whole show just on that topic.
I would love to.
Tell you about how I saw Dial M for Murder in 3D.
That's one of the better ones.
It really is. Hitch, you know, shooting through the fish tank.
Yeah. Hitch actually understood 3D and actually understood a way of using 3D to tell a story, which...
And Martin Scorsese, and I'm not sure if there are too many other people.
Yeah, that's true, too. Yeah, with... I forget the name of the Scorsese film.
Hugo.
That's right. And it's between Dial M for 3D, Hugo, and Gravity, and that's like...
Yeah, that's about it.
I don't even include Avatar in there, because...
Avatar is a whole other thing. That was a proof of concept.
Yeah. And he proved the concept, and all the studio said, that's great. We can make more money with this. We're just not going to do any freaking thing with it. I've got...
Except he's got how many movies coming out with that premise. He's slated for 5 films in the next 10 years. Yeah. Getting back and you didn't mention my favorite credit of yours because it's in the past, but how I first knew of you was Ciné Fantastique.
Ciné Fantastique, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was a journalist and a critic and for a brief time editor of CFQ.
Yeah, and I thought that was the best of the fanish movie zines.
Because it was.
That's
and much as it was a fanish publication, and you know, we did have to kowtow to the studios as much as needed, we did treat ourselves as journalists.
So getting back to what we were talking about, which is one of the recent releases of the most successful movie of the year in terms of box office.
Yeah.
Which is to say 10 people went instead of 8.
Exactly. Exactly.
8 people went to see Tenet and 10 people went to see Wonder Woman.
That was it. The door's out.
Now let me start with a quick prelude. I am not a fan of most of the DC movies. Mm-hmm. I think the last really good one was directed by Tim Burton.
Okay. Line starts at the rear, buddy.
Yeah. And I'm trying to get people to start a hashtag, which is cut the Snyder release. as opposed. And my understanding is that the cutting the Snyder, releasing the Snyder cut may very well be the last thing that he does for DCEU, which is DC Extended Universe.
Let me give you a theory, and it's only a theory, is that one of the things that I think Wonder Woman 84...
Well, before we get there,
okay. Well,
I had a little rap that had, you know, it's just about DC versus Marvel.
Okay, go ahead.
Comic books, which is what they were once upon a time. Before they were, I mean, there was Captain America. Was it Republic? I think it was Republic, and there was a Superman, of course, Max Fleischer. Was genius with those. And Marvel didn't exist at the time. But the difference between a Marvel comic and a DC comic was the DC comic, the cover didn't have anything to do with what was inside the story. Even the frontispiece didn't either, although it came closer. You'd read that issue, and you're pretty much like... done. The thing is that you didn't have to follow it. It was read and toss. Or the way that Harlan Ellison put it is not a coincidence that a comic book takes just about the right amount of time for a bathroom session. Yes. And those aren't the words he used. And Marvel, even from the very early Stanley, Jack Kirby days, you know, before Chris Claremont and the other folk came in to turn it into more serious stuff, Marvel asked you to really get involved. Even with Doctor Strange and Fantastic Four and Strange Tales and Nick Fury and all of those. And the movies have continued to fulfill that. The DC movies, not counting the trilogy by Christopher Nolan, and not counting some exceptions here and there, were just like the comic books, especially when Zack Snyder is doing them. Mm-hmm. Throwaways. Yeah. You watch it, it's like popcorn devoid of content. Not very good. And that includes Watchmen, which was, you know, supposed to be heavy, man. And all that. Whereas the Marvel movies, they start bringing in auteur cinema people eventually, not counting, you know, Incredible Hulk. But they were getting avant-garde people. Avant-garde actors. Robert Downey, his career was not at a good place when he did Iron Man. They were using lesser characters. But at the end of each of the movies, maybe Samuel Jackson would show up mid-credits and promise you something and they're building up until they finally created an Avengers. As far as I'm concerned, the only really good one to date. This is, for me, the point. With Marvel movies, and God, those TV shows look weird. Loki and
I don't know what Disney is doing. Disney is doing the same thing with their franchises that they did with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Well, people love this, so let's run it every single day of the week.
And well, there's that, but it's also if you take a look at the content.
Yeah, I haven't. I've kind of shied away from actually delving too far.
No, you have to take a look.
Yeah,
you really do. The realities are not what they seem. These have the kind of continuity there. Imagine Marvel movies by Charlie Kaufman turned into a TV series, and you're starting to get an idea of where they're going with WandaVision.
I'm curious about WandaVision. I will say that. I saw the trailer for that. I know absolutely nothing about the franchise from which it is born. I forget which Avengers.
It comes out of Avengers Endgame.
Yeah, I know that. The Vision. The Vision, that's what it is, right?
Vision.
Yes.
As he was created by Tony Stark using one of the gemstones.
Right.
That goes into the Infinity Stones.
Right.
That goes into Thanos' glove, and that stone is destroyed. They're all destroyed. And yet here, after all that destruction, here in a television universe that moves from decade to decade to decade, they find themselves in sort of a sitcom, except that characters who don't belong start showing up.
Right.
And villains start showing up, and reality changes. Loki is weirder than that. Just go to YouTube.
In any case, you know,
I'm saying is my expectations for a good Wonder Woman movie, I have problems with the first, because the first two thirds are wonderful, and then all of a sudden it
falls.
Everybody
talks about the ending, the clash at the end,
And you know, now that the new movie has come out, Patty Jenkins has told us a little about that.
Yeah, and we probably both read the same articles, and we can fill that in. Let me just say this about WW84 or Wonder Woman 84 or Wonder Woman 1984. I wish they'd make up their minds.
The 84 had nothing to do with the movie. So outside of the music and the dress styles, setting the movie in 1984 made no sense.
No, I would disagree with that, but let me just say this about my overall feeling about the film is that for the first act, for the first hour of it, I was really actively hating it. I was starting to be won over. About an hour into it, I went, "Oh, it's a comic book movie," which we haven't really gotten from particularly the DC universe. And once I snagged onto that, I was able to relax. It is still a righteous mess, but there are very good things about it. I think the core...
That was why I did that entire rap about what I expected out of a Marvel comic versus a DC comic. It's a DC comic.
It's a DC comic. And it's got, I think, what is a clever villain in Pedro Pascal's role.
Mando, yeah.
In it, Maxwell Lord. I like the idea that he becomes an animate monkey paw. That's a nice idea. I think it grows... Here's the thing, and you had mentioned this about Patty Jenkins. There have been these articles that have been going around in the past few days about how Patty Jenkins had to fight to have both prologues in the film. And for those who haven't seen Wonder Woman 84, all two of you, there's essentially...
Well, I wouldn't have done it if I wasn't able to... Yeah. It was a big decision whether or not to get HBO. It's expensive.
Yes.
They have a lot of good content, but I've already got Netflix and Amazon and Acorn and, most importantly, Turner Classic Movies. Yeah,
we can talk about that because that's the future there. But the thing about... Here's the thing, is that there are two prologues. The first one is set on Themyscira with Diana Prince as a young girl competing in a competition with lots of older Amazons, and the second is Wonder Woman foiling what appears at first to be a jewelry robbery. It's actually something more than that. And Pat, what it turns out is, as I said, there's been these articles saying Patty Jenkins had to fight to get both of those prologues into the film. And what I think happened, the way Patty Jenkins puts it, and she was sort of dodgy about what her choice was. Patty Jenkins put it as Warner's told me you can have one or the other, but not both. My feeling is that the Themyscira feels more like what the original Wonder Woman film, the first Wonder Woman film, is more of a piece with the first Wonder Woman film than the jewelry heist sequence. And the jewelry heist sequence, I think, is indicative of Warner's, the higher-ups, the business side of Warner's, wresting the DCEU away from the filmmakers, because the jewelry heist thing feels more to me like what a marketing team would think is an action film with a dollop of girl power, quote unquote, girl power in it. And the film has a battle overall between what Patty Jenkins originally did with the first Wonder Woman, and what DC is trying to do, and essentially here again, pull the DC franchise away from what was necessarily Zack Snyder's cold, dark, bitter grip.
Yeah, and so, although his credit is still on this.
His credit is still on it, and he's actually credited as producer. I checked.
But a producer doesn't mean
producer
much.
Still means something. Executive producer don't mean nada. Yeah. Okay, and there's a difference there. The executive producer, what the executive producer is responsible for is the crushing burden of cashing the check to have their name in the credits. That's what an executive producer is for. Producers actually do something. So, but there's something like 40 producers on the film. So
that's true for most films. There's a line producer.
God knows how much Zack Snyder was involved. But
I suspect he was involved with the third act of the first film. It's got his fingerprints over.
That's probably true. That's probably true. But I would say the same thing here about at least as far as the Warner higher ups are concerned, their involvement that resulted in the film being rather choppy and sort of glossing over things like. If you haven't seen the film, Steve Trevor comes back because Diana wishes him back. But he comes back in the body of another person, somebody whose body he has taken over. And throughout the film, they never deal with that issue. There is never a point where they say, oh, my God, you've stolen somebody's life. And even when
and what happened to that person?
What happened to that person? And even when Diana
I think he became a jazz pianist.
OK, you want to go to Seoul right now? We can do that. No,
just about. we don't need to run this into the ground, but I think you made your point.
I never thought of Seoul being in the DC universe. Oh, my God. it's going to start now. We did it.
I think we did. It'll make a great mashup.
But getting back to Wonder Woman, though, the thing continuing about how they've handled it is flawed is that even when Diana renounces her wish, it's not because they've stolen somebody's life. It's because she needs to get her power back.
Right.
And even at the
but to me, that's DC Comics.
Do you think so? Do you think they well?
I was never a DC Comics fan.
Yeah, for that reason. Yeah, I will agree with you there. That would be the reason if we were talking about a comic book movie. That's the way they would do it. But
I think that's exactly what this was a comic book movie.
But I think if it was Patty Jenkins with a tighter grip on the wheel, the issue would have been dealt with. Because the first Wonder Woman had a lot more nuance to how it dealt with its issues.
Well, and we'll see. I don't know where they're going to try to fast track Wonder Woman 3, but we'll see what happens with Cleopatra and with the next Star Wars movie.
Which
are both.
If there is the next Star Wars movie, I wonder whether we're ever going to see another Star Wars movie.
Well, they're talking about, you know, what is it, 2024?
Yeah, that's which is a way of a ways off.
I think that the movie industry, you know, that Tarantino has seen his worst nightmare come true, and he and Nolan, Christopher Nolan, are sitting their hands on hips, and I bleed for them. I really do. Mm-hmm. I understand. Having said that, the movie theater industry, I think, is going to continue in one of two ways. One will be following something like the Alamo Draft House niche, where you have like 6 or 7 films, and they'll be doing festivals in each one, and they're more than theaters. They serve food. It's an experience. Mm-hmm. And the other one is theaters for tentpoles.
With each film, and so the corporate wing doesn't get so antsy about what film is coming out and interferes less and lets the filmmakers do their work with less interference. This is my pipe dream, quite frankly. I'm not
sure. Although it can be done, this is something they need to learn. I sent you an email about a movie Barbara and I watched. Fast Color, was that the name?
Yeah, Fast Color, which I haven't watched yet. I do have it on my list.
Yeah, okay, so here's a movie that is a superhero or supernatural power movie that will probably be a TV series. It plays very much like a pilot. Mm-hmm. And it's got a budget of 25 cents.
Yeah.
And it doesn't suffer for it at all.
Similarly, for another film on Amazon Prime, Vast of Night. Have you watched that yet?
No, I haven't.
It's an incredible film. It was done by a guy, and I think he's out of Texas, who prior to this actually was only directing commercials. And it's an incredible film. It's in some ways a throwback. It's a throwback to a type of filmmaking where the dialogue becomes as important and crucial as the visuals. It's a very filmic experience still, but a lot of it is about the dialogue and people talking about things. And it's an amazing little film. And here again, it was done for an insanely low budget. And it's frankly at the top of my list of the best films this year.
Yeah. One of the reasons I love your reviews is that I see that you're reviewing a movie called blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, what the F? I've never heard of this film. Why is he doing that? And it's always very interesting. And I think that the loss of the rise of the tentpoles and the loss of the average movie that costs way too much, including advertising budget, is going to help the smaller films. I think we will see more from Amazon, probably, God help us, Apple. Certainly.
I suspect this is the way it's going to go. Ironically, I was thinking about this, and my opinion of the year was that this was a fabulous year for film. Because we didn't have...
Change that, cinema.
It's a fabulous year for cinema.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and this is a conversation with Dan Persons, recorded last Thursday. And you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and this is a conversation with Dan Persons, recorded last Thursday.
And that's why they're able to be turning out these, 10 series of Marvel television series and about 6 Star Wars shows. And with any luck, an independent producer might be able to walk in there and say, I've got an idea that utilizes this craft.
Yeah. Hopefully so. We'll see how that goes. Do you want to talk about Soul at all? Or?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, because...
Pixar comes in B-. I don't know if they've ever had a B. A-, A, and A+.
The
only B- movie I can think of really is The Good Dinosaur, and maybe Cars 3.
Yeah. They have a few, and I didn't see Cars 3. I avoided Cars 3. I don't want to even think about
Cars 3. For just that reason, yeah.
This film, I would say, I'm not going to do this because I actually hate giving ratings. So I'm not going to give it a rating, okay? I don't like being...
I wasn't rating it as so much placing it in terms of my favorites.
Yeah, okay. I see. This film, continues what I've been seeing with Pete Docter in the last few films, which is that I get the feeling he tends, and let me say this. I like Soul, and yes, I teared up at the end. Inside Out was that he worked really hard to try to cover every sort of aspect of human emotion. And so you had theme parks, and you had memory modules, and you had the archives, and you had a train of consciousness and a realm of abstraction. And once again, I teared up, and it's a great movie. It's a great movie. But
the saddest part to me is the loss of that doll, that memory.
Actually, you know what got to me is that at the near the very end, when she changes her mind and she runs back home and she confesses to her parents and they hug her. And it's just the sort of sigh that it gets me.
Yeah,
it gets me right there, and I lose it at that point. So
yeah, although it's not the single most emotional moment in any Pixar film, and I know you will not disagree with me, comes about 17 and a half minutes into Up.
Well, yes. Yeah. No argument. And we'll leave it there. A great film. And it is a great film. And the rest of it, I think, is pretty damn great too.
Yeah, it goes from being a great film to being a good film.
But it carries. I still think it is a great film.
Yeah.
but now we've got soul, and what he was doing with emotions in Inside Out, he's now doing with spirituality.
Yes.
In this film. And I think the metaphor for the way the film feels for me is that there is a sequence set in a place called the Hall of Everything. Just to fill in, there's a jazz musician. Hold on.
We just have to explain to those who haven't seen it, because it is, after all, available only on Disney Plus.
Right, right. There's a jazz musician voiced by Jamie Foxx, and he dies, and he...
A wannabe jazz musician.
He's a jazz musician.
He's a teacher.
He's a good musician. Yeah. But he dies. John Batiste does his piano work, by the way.
Yeah.
But he dies, and he goes to... He's on the way to the afterworld. He escapes from there lands up in the realm where proto souls are being raised and trained for their trip.
It's all very Theodore Sturgeon or Henry Kuttner.
Yeah.
It's in that line of 40s science fiction, metaphysical comedy.
Yeah.
With serious overtones or undertones. Science fiction, and they do it well.
Yeah, they do it well, but here's the thing, and again, this is sort of my feeling about Pete Docter and, if you want, Overkill, is that in that realm, there is a place called the Hall of Everything, and that supposedly has everything about the earthly experience contained within it. We spend less than 5 minutes in that Hall of Everything. So here is a film where you spend less than 5 minutes covering everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the
other... Because for all of its quality and all of its brilliant animation, they're asking you to use your mind's eye.
Yeah. Yeah, I can agree with that.
And that also relates to, and we won't spoil it, but that relates to how the film ends.
Right. It's true, too. The thing about that, though, is that, and Pixar tends to do this a lot, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, is that if you've only seen the trailers for Soul, that is not what the film is about. That isn't the plot of the film. And it's not really a spoiler, because it is what the story is.
It's the launching point.
It's the launching point. Everything that you've seen in the trailer is the launching point of the film. It's actually about this musician becoming or being assigned as mentor to a soul, number 22. And by the way, but my significant other pointed this out for me, is that in the sequence where he's introduced to number 22, before that, somebody else is assigned to soul number 6,443,200,000. And then he is introduced to soul number 22. So you get
been there a couple of billion years.
That soul has been there around. Voiced by Tina Fey, by the way, who also does a good job. But the actual story of the film is that they stumble their way out of this way station and down to Earth. He's trying to get back to his body, which is in a coma in a hospital. And there is also there what they call an emotional support cat, which I don't know if there's actually a thing, but that's actually a thing. But you go with it for the story. The point is that the musician lands in the cat, and number 22 winds up in the musician's body, and that's the plot of the film, is him now trying to get back to his own body.
And they haven't done a plot like that since Dick Powell ended up inside of a horse. And I forget who the other horse was.
Yeah. And that raises an interesting issue, because in Soul, what you've got are the two characters that you see there. And when the musician talks, he talks with Tina Fey's voice. And when the cat talks with Jamie Foxx's voice. And it actually works better in All of Me, because in All of Me, it's Steve Martin still talking in his voice, but acting like Lily Tomlin. So, I mean, that's my feeling about Soul, though, is that once again, basically all the stuff that you think the film is going to be about is in the first half hour. And I forgot to mention the Zen pirates in there as well. There are also Zen pirates in that first
half
hour.
There's a lot of adventure, just like there is in Inside Out.
Yeah. And
Let me ask you a philosophical question. Are these films for kids?
My impression with this is that
I know it's strange.
This film, Pixar is really moving away from kids.
Yeah.
I don't, how is a kid supposed to connect with this film? It's dealing
I don't know, but if you are a kid, I would ask you, please send me an email of talking about your feeling about it to Jim, J-I-M, at ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, as long as you are 15 or under. I really want to hear your take on Soul.
You know, you can say that kids will connect with the animation, and there's lots of fun animation, and quite frankly,
little kids are going to love it. Yeah,
quite frankly, this again pushes the envelope for Pixar in terms of animation, just in terms of the visuals. This film is incredible. And
it is approaching not animation.
As far as CBS All Access is concerned, I am on there for Discovery. And I waited
on TV. It's on Channel 2 in New York.
That's the first season.
Yeah. They'll get around to the second season.
Yeah, I'm sure they will, but I wanted to see it now.
And I started watching Picard and stopped.
I'm sorry.
Stopped watching.
Yeah, well, Picard. Yeah, you made the right call there. I God knows what New Frontiers, is that what the
something
Chris,
like that, yeah.
I think it's Star Trek New Frontiers, which is the one that's supposed to be the Christopher Pike one,
right,
which I will check out because
I like Chris Greenwood, but you know, outside of that. Right.
Third season of Discovery, in case anybody cares, is my reaction to it is essentially the same reaction I had with Voyager. It's like, I'm sticking with it for now. Seems to be getting better. If you remember, it wasn't until the third season that Next Gen actually found its footing. So,
yeah, that's absolutely true. But then it was the best of them.
Yeah, the cast of Discovery is overall very good. I am delighted that Doug Jones has gotten his due and is. He's not really the lead of the show, but he's, you know.
I'll settle for The Shape of Water, thank you.
was that him in Shape of Water?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely it is.
You know, I haven't seen that film yet. I keep going, I've got to see this film, and for some reason.
Oh, my God. There are about 400 reasons for you, especially.
I you don't need to tell them to me because I tell them to myself. I don't know why I'm dragging my feet on seeing that, but I'll get to it.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple. Well, I mean, you know, James Brolin is the bad guy. That's never happened before. But the and he's one. They're all wonderful. The lead, Sally. She always does Mike Lee films.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Happy Go Lucky and stuff like that. She's absolutely wonderful. The cast is wonderful, but yes, Doug Jones plays the creature.
Well, I'll have to check that. He was a good interview. He's one of the people that I've interviewed in my many and varied and sundry guises. So
in our 45-minute show at most, we've gone about 64 minutes.
Yes.
Which is okay, because we will still put this up on YouTube and or Facebook.
Okay, that's cool.
And people can see the entire thing there, and it has been interesting. But we've discussed about three movies.
Which is normal, which even when we had 2 hours, we said we're going to discuss this and this and this and this. And then we spend 2 hours talking about two films.
Yeah, but we did, however, cover a couple of things, which is the future of the movie houses.
Yes.
Of cinema. Cinema isn't going anywhere.
No. Yeah, I would agree with you. As
they're ramping up, hopefully, and of course, TV screens will be getting larger.
Yes,
and it's hard not to get one that's 4K.
Yeah,
because now what they're selling is 8K. I'll settle for 4.
Do we have any time? Do we have a few seconds for me to run down my? And it's actually not a top 10 list. It's like a top.
Oh yeah, five. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Let me just run that down, because this is my top nine for 2020. The unofficial number 10, because it wasn't really released in 2020, it was in 2002. But I saw this at like the very end of the year, and it was like the perfect panacea for what the year has been. Japanese film Versus, which we may run the review. Which you may run the review another week.
Soon.
Okay. The rest of the list, this is all 2020. Coco D, Coco Da, the Swedish-Danish horror film. Zombie for Sale, the Korean zombie comedy, which is delightful. Sela and the Spades, which was an interesting African-American take on Shakespearean intrigue set in an elite high school, elite private high school. Lose the Flower of Evil, a kind of religious horror film. Wolf Walkers, the Cartoon Saloon animated film.
I will get my 2 weeks free Apple only to watch that, because every Cartoon Saloon film that I have seen, there are three.
Yeah.
People only think of the two Irish ones.
Right, the two Irish runs, and then there's The Breadwinner, which admittedly I haven't seen for specific reasons, which I shall not go into here.
It's lovely. I prefer the Irish ones.
Yeah.
But it's lovely.
Yeah.
And Wolfwalker, I cannot wait to see.
Wolfwalker is all of a piece. Baccarat, the Brazilian
kind. Which I never heard of until you mentioned it. And then it ended up on Manolo Dargis's best 10 list.
Yeah. And deservedly so. Kind of mashup of John Carpenter, non-genre Attack on Precinct 13. Along with a bit of near future political commentary. Really nice.
That's not the one that's yet another take on Attack the Block, is it?
No, it's not. This is about a small town that gets assaulted by an elite team of mercenaries.
Okay. There was an American version ripping off Attack the Block.
Yeah. This is not that. No, this is Baccarat. Yeah. Diablo Rojo, PTY, a wonderful Evil Dead kind of film out of Panama, of all places. Divine Love, another Brazilian, rather caustic religious commentary film set in the near future. And then we talked about it earlier on, Vast of Night, which is just a wonderful independently produced, quote unquote, alien invasion film, but with much more soul than you think something like that would have.
Yeah. Well, the one that tops my list is Wolfwalkers. Might even be tonight for me.
Do it, because it is a wonderful film.
Yeah, I have no intention of staying with Apple TV, but that film I will see.
Yeah, it's worth your while.
Yeah,
heartily recommend it. All of these films are heartily recommended, except Coco D. Coco Da. Coco D. Coco Da is a rough film.
Okay, fair enough. One time we will discuss the venues.
Yeah.
The nature of the venues, because having something like HBO, it's like there are all these films that I can't see.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get Spirited Away. You can't rent it.
Yeah.
You can't get it because it's in the HBO library.
Yeah.
But, you know, whereas Netflix and Amazon and services emulating them, Hulu, and all those, they're just rotating from one to the next. And you see a headline saying, oh, my God, this great, great film is leaving Netflix on this date. You've got to watch it now before it leaves. And then the next day it's left Netflix and it's on Amazon.
Yeah.
Big deal.
I was going through The Outer Limits, the original two seasons of The Outer Limits. And I got about halfway through the first season and then... It's gone.
It's on somewhere.
It's not that I can find it. It was on Prime Video, and then all of a sudden...
Well, with commercials, it's on Comet.
Oh, okay. Maybe I can track it down on Comet. Let me look on that.
It's bad enough to be on Comet, yeah.
We do what we have to do.
Indeed. Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Once again, let me just remind people that this is the MightyMoviePodcast.com is where people find Dan. You find me mostly on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group. But if you want to write me, especially if you're a younger person and want to talk to me about Pixar films, not Toy Story. I like the Toy Stories, but that's not my question. Write me at jim@ourwolf.com. And we will do this again, Dan.
Please, please.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
been listening to Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you all so much for listening and for your support in a very troubled year. We're hoping this one will be better. We'll be off next week, but we'll return on January 16th at 7 a.m. with an interview with writer Tom Doyle, who will also read for you. Stay tuned for Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Good morning.
WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. We encourage you to become a WBAI buddy. We encourage you to become part of this revitalization of WBAI. Things are looking up. We're getting our finances in order. There's an influx of producers. There's new energy here. We're asking you to become part of that and to feel as though you have a stake in the rebirth of WBAI. Become a WBAI buddy. And each month, a certain amount is taken out of your account. And you set that up by going to give to WBAI.org. And easy breezy. And we'll have sustaining members at a year's time. And it will help lessen the amount of on-air fundraising days that we have. So become a WBAI buddy. Do it now. Go to give to the number 2 WBAI.org.
Saturday on WBAI, The Road to Mecca by South African playwright Ethel Fugard, based on the true story of an older woman who finds meaning in creating a sculpture garden out of broken glass, cement, and wire.
I have to see them very clearly first. They've got to come to me inside like pictures. And if they don't, well, all I can do is wait.
But she comes under attack by the church and her neighbors who try and coerce her out of her home.
Your hobby, if I can call it that, hasn't really helped matters.
That's Ethel Fugard's The Road to Mecca, starring Julie Harris, Amy Irving, and Harris Yulin. Saturday, January 2nd at noon, while Professor Sri Srinivasan, who hosts Coping with COVID, a hopeful, helpful call-in show, is taking a holiday break. And also at 8 p.m. when the Metropolitan Virtual Playhouse is also off for the evening.
When it comes to hypocrisy and blatant hypocrisy at that, you Afrikaners are in a class by yourself.
Hello, I'm Isaac Ferguson. I'm inviting you to tune in on Saturday, 4 to 6 p.m. for Caribbean Voices and Beyond, when we will bring you news, views, and important issues affecting the Caribbean community in particular and the immigrant community in general. Tune in 4 to 6 p.m. to Caribbean Voices and Beyond on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the Internet.
Saturday at 7 for Audio Stages. This week we're presenting The Klemperer's New Clothes by Norman Weiss and Bill Squire. You won't want to miss this delightful musical, so mark your calendars. Saturday, 7 p.m. WBAI. Oh, and by the way, Happy New Year from all of us to all of you.
Gather round, everybody. Gather round.
He's cool. He's exciting.
This dude is bad.
He's sexy. Okay, maybe not. He's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
He's Tony Ryan on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. He's got both.
Break him with the sound of the trumpet.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, I can dig it, yeah.
He's got classic soul. He's okay. I can't think of anything else.
I'm Tony Ryan. Tune in Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to 1 a.m.
Soul Central Station with Tony Ryan.
99.5 WBAI.
It's autumn. The birds and ear massage are migrating to Sundays, 6 to 8 a.m. I'm Mark Leosa, your ear masseur, inviting you to give ear to ear massage, sound, spoken word, a bit of opera, and maybe music you never heard before, including the bird of the week. Ear massage between Jeff Brady in other news and your morning Ursae with James Ursae here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Ear massage.
Bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory?
McDonough John and McCourt Malachy are on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, on Sundays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Topics, wit, wisdom, wackery, sausages. Join us, please.
But not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory?
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft. Little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him. And without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal, hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? and he said the same bunch to wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
If you start off each day with a song.
Thank you, Jimmy Durante, and good morning, Sean Rhodes, at the helm in Brooklyn. Back from a rest. Hope you're well. And to all of you, good morning. I know I'm David Rothenberg. The program's any Saturday. I know I'm supposed to, what I am supposed to begin with, but I'm withholding Happy New Year's until January 20th, when I can believe what I'm saying. In the meantime, the man who cries fraud has shifted blame on yet another of his failures. Promises had poured forth from the lips of his toadies. You may have seen them on various news interviews, that 20 million vaccines would be injected into the arms of American citizens by the end of 2020. The actual number fell short of 3 million, or 17 million short of the plan. The loser has blamed the states. He's blamed others. Blaming other people is one of his more recognizable attributes. If some states are having logistical problems, it might have been suggested to Trump to get his fat ass out of Mar-a-Lago's golf sand traps, pick up a phone to various governors around the country to see if the federal government could provide leadership and solutions. Operation Warp Speed is what he's called it. It should be renamed Operation Turtle. But as the second treacherous COVID wave is killing thousands of Americans, the loser is still crying about election fraud. As a matter of fact, he left the party, didn't attend his party in Washington, in Mar-a-Lago, came back to Washington for God knows what else. To deal with this issue resolved by the courts at every level. Every day he remains in office is costing American lives. We are a nation of dying citizens, and a putting putz is at the helm. The scientists did their job, and all that Trump talked about was taking credit for the fast delivery of the vaccine. His administration could never have been anything but a disaster because he is a despicable human being. And he could never attract or maintain a staff that would stick around long enough to achieve anything. Anything positive, that is. The epidemic is Trump's legacy. He's a loser. He lost. And when he's gone, I'll say Happy New Year. Not till then. And interestingly, he did leave before the Mar-a-Lago party, although 500 people New Year's Eve gathered there, including sons, Donald Jr. and Eric, daughter, whatever her name is, and her husband, Jared, Ivanka, one of those. No, maskless. You know, it's interesting. Three parties in New York were closed, justifiably and understandably so, fine, because there were people gathering without masks, celebrating the New Year's Eve. I don't know what they had in mind. But down in Mar-a-Lago, defying all Palm Beach edicts, there they were. And it cost people over $1,000 to attend, and there were 500 of them. And according to Instagrams and all those other things that technology puts forth, they were maskless, and they were celebratory. If you want to know what a leader can do in an epidemic, I'm almost finished with it. It's not a fast read, but it's a thorough and absorbing read. It's called A Promised Land, and the author is Barack Obama, the predecessor to Donald Trump. I'm taking time to read a couple of pages to you because it's so relevant to all of this. Even the best organization can't anticipate everything, in which case you have to improvise to meet your objectives or at least to cut your losses. This presidency was no different, except that the surprises came daily, often in waves. And over the course of the spring and summer of the first year, as we wrestled with the financial crisis, two wars, and the push for healthcare reform, several unexpected items got added to our already overlooked plate. The first carried the possibility of a genuine catastrophe. In April, reports surfaced, this must be April 2009, reports surfaced that a worrying flu outbreak in Mexico, the flu was the flu virus usually hits vulnerable populations like the elderly, infants, and asthma sufferers. They get hit the hardest, but the strain appeared to strike young, healthy people and was killing them at a higher than usual rate. Within weeks, people in the United States were falling ill with the virus, one in Ohio, two in Kansas, eight in a single high school in New York City. And by the end of the month, both our Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, and the World Health Organization, WHO, had confirmed that we were dealing with a variation of H1N1 virus. In June, the WHO officially declared the first global pandemic in years. In case you don't remember, the WHO is what, in the middle of the pandemic, Trump withdrew the United States from its membership, shared information worldwide. I had, back to Obama, I had more than a passing knowledge of the H1N1 after working on U.S. pandemic preparedness when I was in the Senate. What I knew scared the hell out of me. In 1918, a strain of H1N1 that came to be known as the Spanish flu had infected an estimated 500 million people and killed somewhere between 50 and 100 million, roughly 4% of the world's population. In Philadelphia, more than 12,000 people died in the span of a few weeks. The effects of the pandemic were beyond the stunning death tolls and shutdown of economic activity. Later research would reveal that those who were in utero during the pandemic grew up to have lower incomes, poorer educational outcomes, and higher rates of physical disability. It was too early to tell how deadly the new virus would be. This is in 2009. But I wasn't interested in taking any chances. On the same day that Catherine Sebelius was confirmed as HHS secretary, we sent a plane to pick her up from Kansas, flew her to the Capitol to be sworn in at a makeshift ceremony, and immediately asked her to spearhead a two-hour conference call with WHO officials, World Health Organization officials, and health ministers from Mexico and Canada. A few days later, we pulled together an interagency team to evaluate how ready the United States were for worst case scenario. The answer was we weren't at all ready. Annual flu shots didn't provide protection against H1N1. It turned out, because vaccines generally weren't a money-making